Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the Tech Guy is provided by CacheFly. CacheFly.com. Hi, this is Leo Laporte. This is my Tech Guy podcast. The show originally aired on the Premier Networks on Sunday, March 4th, 2018. This is episode 1468. Enjoy. The Tech Guy podcast is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage, by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. And by Fracture. Fracture is a photo decor company that prints your photos directly onto glass, then delivers them to your door ready to display right out of the box. Visit fracture.me and use the code TechGuy15 at checkout, and you'll get 15% off your first order. And by IT Pro TV, binge-worthy learning for IT pros. Visit itpro.tv/techguy and use the code TG30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. Well, hey, how are you today? Good to see you. Leo Laporte here. I'm the Tech Guy, and this is the show where we talk tech. I guess that makes sense. Compute. What is tech? Well, anything with a chip in it, computers or the internet or home theater or Google goggles or... Actually, Snapchat spectacles are back in the news. They're making version 2 of the Snapchat spectacles. I have my pair. I'll put them on for the show just so I look ever so dashing. These are the spectacles with the cameras built in. Kind of like Google Glass, except not. What else do we talk about? Hey, smartphones, for sure. We've been talking a lot about the Samsung Galaxy S9 coming out in a couple of weeks. We talk about smartwatches. There can be but one. Although we had a great call, I have to say, last show from a guy who said, you know, you ought to take a look at this this Garmin smartwatch. And I was very impressed. What was it? It's the HR, right? Looked very nice. Has a heart rate, GPS. Very nice. If, a little less than the Apple Watch. Right in there, I guess. The lowest cost Apple Watch. So we could talk about those too. Dashboard cams. Oh, I've been playing with one I really like. I have to say, I like it so much I actually tucked the cables in. That's a sign. I'm going to keep that one. And this one, it's easy to tuck the cables in. It's something called the Owl Cam. And the start, it's a startup. In fact, they just started shipping. If you ordered today, you wouldn't get it till the end of the month. I ordered it, when I first read about it, and I got it on Friday. And I've never really felt the need for a dashboard cam, but there's certain, you know, if you get in an accident, it's nice to have evidence that it wasn't your fault. This one has cameras front and back, so you feel like an Uber driver or a taxi cab driver. You're being recorded at the same time. And if there is an incident, it records front and back and, you know, the 30 seconds preceding it, which is kind of interesting because if you weren't paying attention, it will record that. Mm-hmm. Might be good for a teenager's automobile. It has its own GPS built in and a variety of sensors, compass, accelerometer. Records all that stuff. They have LTE built into it too, so it has its own connectivity, which means it can start uploading after an accident immediately. It also has lights pointing into the car. Now, that's not for while you're driving because it would kind of effectively blind you since it's right in front of you. But if somebody breaks into your car, the lights come on and they record the action and then notify you. That's where the LTE comes in handy. You get notification something's going on. Not cheap, $350, but in the ballpark for dual direction cameras. You can get for $100, you can get even less for just a camera that plugs into your cigarette lighter and points out the front window. But you want to get one that's high resolution out the front. This one's 4K. That means you could zoom in and read a license plate in theory. I haven't tested that, but in theory. It has an unusual powering system. Instead of plugging into an accessory port or a cigarette lighter on your car, It plugs into the onboard diagnostics port. A lot of people don't even know they have one. It's a funny kind of trapezoidal, is that the right word or is it a rhombus? It's a rhomboid port under, I have to think back to my high school geometry. It's a rhomboid port underneath your, right around underneath your steering wheel, usually on the left. It's in all cars. Is it a rhomboid or a trapezoid? It's a trapezoid. John is correcting me. Thank you, John. Is it daylight saving time or savings time? John, this is how I get John to jump up. He comes in. If I say daylight savings time, he comes running in. That's coming up next week, right? It is a trapezoidal shape port that is really there for a diagnostic, obviously, when you bring it into the car. That's why it's called the onboard diagnostic ports. When you bring it to the dealer or the repair shop, they plug in their fancy doohickeys and that they can tell all sorts of stuff about the car. But it turns out, unlike the cigarette lighter, it has power all the time, even when the car is off. And so you plug, it has a little adapter you plug into that gets your power. That's all. It's not collecting data from the OBD port. And then a wire, which it turns out is very easy to kind of, they even give you a crevice tool. You can shove the wire in the crevice going around by the door and then around in the front where the dashboard meets the windshield. There's a crevice there and you can tuck it in. And so it's a very tidy, easy install. You don't have to get an installer to do it. It's very tidy. And as I said, now that I didn't tuck it in the first time because I thought, well, we'll see. But now that I've used it a while, I'm tucking it in. And that's a tuck in. That's a keeper. Owl Cam, I think it's owlcam.com. Anyway, I just wanted to say I'm impressed. And there's some things it needs to do. For instance, right now, I don't think you can have another person get your owl data. I mean, it's very privacy focused. But if you got in an accident and you couldn't get to your phone and the phone got destroyed, it'd be nice to have another place that the owl could send that data to. I think we'll also, remember when a meteorite? That hit the, or a comet, or what's that? It was some sort of space object, hit the lake in Russia. Remember that some years ago? And for the first time ever, you could see a lot of video of it. Because people had dashboard cams in Russia. It was very common. Comet. Get it? Very common. And the Chelyabinsk, or was it the Tunguska event? I don't know. Anyway, the Tunguska event was in 1908. We didn't have video of that because there weren't any dashboard cams in 1908. But this time, you saw a ton of video because I guess, I'm thinking in Russia, you better have a dashboard cam. Just be a good idea. Keep an eye on what's going on so you have proof. So a lot of people have them, and there was a lot of video of that amazing meteorite hitting the Earth. So I'm ready. If Bigfoot wanders across my path, I will have video from the Owl Cam. Bought it with my own money. They didn't send it to me. Another thing you can do, because it is always on, you can on your phone go see who's in your car or what's going on with your car. And it has a speaker and a microphone in it. So you hear audio, but you can also speak. So I scared my wife the other day. She was driving my car, and I said, "Honey," and she went, "Where are you?" I'm in the camera, honey. So that's handy. Oh yes, I like to bring you interesting new gadgets. I do. The rumors are strong. Apple will be releasing not one, not two, but three iPhones this fall. I know. It's just practically March. Why are we talking about 6 months off? Because that's what you do with iPhones. Three iPhones, one gigantic iPhone. All of them will be kind of based on the iPhone X. The gigantic iPhone will be the high end. I think Apple's trying to figure out how much we're willing to spend. Gee, they bought the $1,000 phone. Should we try $1,100? It'll be 6.5 inches, but the same size as roughly as an iPhone 8 right now, or 8 Plus, I guess, the Plus size phones, because of this edge-to-edge screen. It'll have a notch. The notch is here to stay. In fact, at Mobile World Congress this week, there were manufacturers who showed phones with notches. This is something a lot of people thought, oh, it's a shame Apple has to do the notch, but they have to put some, you know, they have to put somewhere for the cameras and the sensors to be. But I guess now it's a status symbol, a notch. Asus with its Zenfone not only said they have a notch, but they said our notch is 26% smaller than Fruit Phone X, they called it. It's the end of times, I really think. 8888 Ask Leo, that's the phone number. The phone or the website is techguylabs.com. I'd love to hear from you. Give me a jingle. Get those phones a ringing. Let's talk high tech. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We're going to take a break, come back, and I will be answering the phone. So get those phones ringing. Kim Schaffer's waiting. She's been waiting all morning for her phone to ring. Oh, look at that. It's ringing. We'll get to your calls right after this. It's a trapezoid.
It's ringing. Okay.
Not a rhombus. Rhombuses are like that.
Right.
Trapezoids are like
right.
that. Exactly. Got it.
And, okay, so asteroids are out there.
Asteroids and comets are out there. Meteorites are what hit the ground.
No.
Roids?
Meteors are what are shooting stars.
Yeah.
If they hit the ground, the thing that's left is a meteoroid.
Meteorite. The thing that's left is a meteorite. All right. Let's see what the Hubble site says. What's the difference between a meteor, a meteorite, an asteroid, and a comet? Good. I said all those words. Okay. A debris is called a meteoroid. The debris.
Yeah.
It's a piece of interplanetary matter that's smaller than a kilometer, frequently only millimeters in size. Most meteoroids are so small they vaporize. If part of a meteorite survives the fall through the atmosphere and lands on Earth, that's the meteorite. That's the thing that you have in your pocket is a meteorite. Asteroids are larger chunks. We don't know. Comets, they're asteroid, but they're ice or men. Yeah, they have a coma. So really, a meteoroid, you're right, that is what that was, is a meteor.
Well, no, this hit, this they found where this thing hit. So.
But the pieces they got were meteorites.
Right, exactly.
It's unclear whether a meteor or it was, well, it landed, right?
Yeah, they found a hole.
Let me see, Russian meteoroid, landed in a lake, right?
That was a big one in 1906.
Meteor hits Russia. In Chelyabinsk, here meteorite hit Russia. Here it comes, up north above Kazakhstan. And see all these dashboard cams, we were able to see it. Whoa! Holy camoly! Wow! Leo Laporte, the tech guy. I love... okay, so... We've had a extended discussion on meteoroids, meteorites, and meteors. It was the Russian meteor that hit in 2013 was over a kilometer. So even though it broke into three pieces, it was a meteor that turned into a meteoroid. And then if you picked up any pieces and put them in your pocket, those are meteorites. Can we just agree to call it a meteor? A meteor? 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 It's a meteor. What do you... I don't know. It's I don't know. Kim Schaffer, hello. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. Deep discussion on a Sunday morning.
It's a meteor. But what's interesting is there's a lot of video of it because in 2013, it seems like everybody in Russia had a camera.
Oh.
So there's a lot of video of this thing coming in, which is kind of cool.
You'd probably stand up there with your camera if it was coming.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I have this dashboard cam. I don't have to now. I just have to point the car at whatever's happening. What's amazing to me is these Russian drivers seeing this thing coming straight at them don't seem to slow down. They just.
I'd be going the other direction.
I would jam on the brakes. I'd say, what the heck is that? But we do know a lot more than we ever did, thanks to all those dash cams, apparently, about meteors hitting the Earth. Now, let's move on to technology. You have been carefully cultivating a group of callers for making this show what it is and what it will be, because this show is made of people.
It is, not meteors.
Not meteors. It's made of people who call us. And who should I start with today?
Larry, right here in Petaluma, has a question about his newly cloned operating system.
He's in the building.
He might be. I told him to just come here
come
and ask
on over,
his question
Larry.
In person.
Hi, Larry. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Welcome.
Hi, Leo. Good to talk to you again. A couple of months ago, I had asked you about cloning my operating system from my desktop PC onto an SSD.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that with the Ease US backup
Very nice.
Tool.
Yeah, that's good stuff. And it's,
everything. I even did the programs, and believe it or not, it's all working great.
Well, yeah, and you know, we talked about that yesterday, and that is fine if you take everything. You're making, that's why clone is the right word for this. You're making a direct, you're not copying the hard drive. You're actually making a sector by sector direct copy of the drive. So, of course, everything's going to work exactly as it did. The only issue would be if you moved it to a new computer, then Windows might be very confused because, of course, it has drivers and software for the old computer. But you can, it's the same computer. You just changed the drive.
Yeah, so I did encounter another issue, and that's the SSD is 250 gigabytes. My Windows partition that I cloned over was about 150, and I can't use the remaining 82 and change gigabytes on the drive because it won't let me expand.
Oh, that's annoying. So a good sector copier will handle that by, you know, different disparate drive sizes, but Ease US obviously didn't. Sigh.
Is there something I can do now in retrospect?
So you've gone into the storage manager and you've tried to resize it, and it says I won't.
Yeah, that's grayed out. When I look at expand, it's grayed out, and I've tried to do it. My other idea was to try and perhaps back it up using what's the name of that program? Acronis True Image.
Yeah, some programs, imaging programs, will do that. They will. In fact, I think Acronis will do that. Do you already have it?
I have it, yeah. So if I back up that whole partition, but there's the C partition, which is 150 gigabytes. There's a 100 megabyte healthy EFI system partition, and there's a 500 megabyte healthy recovery partition.
Yeah, you're going to leave that. Use the partition manager to just get your original partition.
There are reasons,
you're Windows 10, right?
Yes.
Yeah, there are reasons why Windows will decline to do that, partly because it's not the best partitioner in the whole wide world. So you may find, Ease US also makes a partition manager. You may try that, and I believe that's free, and see if you can expand it where Windows Manager would not.
Well, that's the program I used to transfer it over, and at the time I did not see a way to do that. I can try it again, but if I use the Acronis and I back it up, and then but I have to then format the SSD and then restore it again?
No, you're just going to delete that partition. And so what will happen is you're going to leave the recovery partition. You don't want to mess with that. But you're going to delete the partition that you're using for Windows and everything else, the main partition.
Okay.
You should be able to do all this within Acronis, but delete that part. First, obviously, image it, then delete it. And then you're going to restore the image to the free space on the drive. And you'll have to look and read the Acronis manual and so forth, but there will be a way to expand it into a drive that's larger than the original partition.
Okay.
So and you may also take a look at resizing the partition with something besides Windows, because Windows 10 often declines to resize a partition when other programs might. So that'd be the easiest thing.
I'll look at the Ease US again and see if that'll.
Yeah, see if you can expand the partition. Yeah, any partition manager will probably do a better job than the Windows 10 partition manager. Obviously you treat this as a backup and be careful. I presume I have the old hard drive, so you have the original, but this is always, when you start messing around with this stuff, you can have trouble with it. This is not unusual. Maybe I did recommend Ease US. Generally what I tell people when they're doing this, the company that makes the hard drive you just bought, whether it's Seagate or Hitachi or actually they're all owned by Seagate or Western Digital now, I think, will offer a free program for doing this, a sector copy program for doing this. And in every case I've seen, those sector copy programs merely copy whatever's on the old drive to the new drive and use all and create a partition of the full size of the drive. They don't worry so much about that. So EaseUS has a partition program specifically for doing this called Partition Master. And there is a free version of that. So that's another one to try. 888-ASK-LEO, that's the phone number if you want to talk high tech. 888-827-5536. If you have a better idea, you can also call or leave it on our webpage, techguylabs.com. It's free, and comments are always appreciated. Always scary playing with disk partitions, and yet seems to be one of those things you just have to do a lot of. Maybe just it's Windows people have to do a lot of. I don't know. Our show today, it does. I do find myself doing that a lot. Our show today brought to you by Rocket Mortgage. Quicken Loans, love them. Best lender. I mean, in terms of customer support, they are the number one lender in the country, I think. And J.D. Power agrees. Number one in customer satisfaction, 8 years running now for mortgage origination. They have decided, Quicken Loans, because they're such, you know, geeks, they realized that the mortgage process really was kind of broken. It was old-fashioned. It was, you know, you go to a bank and you fill out a 20-page application, and then you've got to go back home and find documents and call the other lenders and other banks and get all their documents, and it's just a pain in the butt. It takes a long time. You know, maybe a few weeks. In my case, last time we bought a house, it was well over a month. We had to go. We were going on a vacation. We thought it'll be done by the time we go on vacation. We were still in the process on vacation. We were faxing stuff from vacation. We had to call Lisa's sister and said, "Debbie, would you go and find something and have them fax it over to the bank?" Oh, that's the worst. Fortunately, Rocket Mortgage to the rescue. I'll never do anything else again. Rocket Mortgage completely turns this on its head. It's a complete technological revolution, completely customer focused on this whole process. It comes from Quicken Loans, so big lender with lots of choices. That's important. You can do it on your phone or your desktop or a tablet. All you have to do is point your browser at rocketmortgage.com/techguy. You'll answer a few questions. It's a short application and stuff you already know. You don't have to do any research. You answer the questions. Then, because they have relationships with all the financial institutions, they say, "If with your permission, we'll pull some information about you." You don't have to go to the attic. You don't have to call them. They'll do it. They get all the information, and they're doing this in real time while you're on the phone looking at it. They crunch the numbers based on income, assets, and credits, and a few minutes later, they come back and say, "Okay, these are the loans you qualify for. You choose the rate, the term, the down payment, then you're approved." And all of that took a few minutes, not days, not months, not weeks, not years, not just minutes. RocketMortgage.com. You apply simply, you'll understand fully, and you'll mortgage confidently. RocketMortgage.com/techguy. Actually, please go there so I get credit. Rocket. How did you hear about us? Leo told me. RocketMortgage.com/techguy. Equal housing lender. Licensed in all 50 states. NMLSConsumerAccess.org. Number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage for making the Tech Guy podcast possible. RocketMortgage.com/techguy. Really, they're making Twit possible. Very, very happy with Rocket Mortgage. Thank you, Rocket Mortgage. Norton Ghost. That's what we still call it, ghosting, right? So I'm interested. I just ordered, and I will get in a couple of weeks. I mentioned this yesterday. This is the first Windows on ARM laptop. A pound and a half. HP is claiming 22 hours battery life. It's the NVX2 from HP. It's got 4G LTE. Now, when 5G comes out, this will really be compelling because it only has 4 gigs of RAM, 128 gig hard drive. It's really, you know, the whole theory, I think, is you do everything online. But I think for travel, this is, anyway, I wanted to review, see how fast it is. It's a Snapdragon 835. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number. Back we go to the phones. Tim in Temecula, California is next. Hi, Tim. My pleasure.
I've got a question about, I need to print a bunch of PDFs or a bunch of drawing files. And depending on the customer, I need to put down a job number or serial number on them. But because they're drawings, there's no common blank space. So I was wondering, can I define a box on a PDF that says I need to print a number there, and whichever PDFs I pick, it'll print on there? That makes sense.
Yeah, and it's easy to do unless what you're saying is you want the number to automatically increment, like you want to have it in the printing process automatically stick a number on there and increment. Can you do it? Are you willing to do it manually?
I am doing it manually now. I'm printing them out and actually stamping them.
Well, but I mean, are you willing to do it manually in the PDF, or do you want to have it just kind of like a like an index number that's automatically printed onto the PDF as you print it?
As I print it, I want it to be. So it doesn't need to index. It needs to have the same number.
Oh, that's easy.
But it needs to print in a different spot on each page.
Yeah, you have to do that by hand. No printer's smart enough to go, oh, let's see, I'll put it here. So what you're going to have to do on each PDF is create a text field. You can do this with anything that edits PDFs can do this. So
right.
Obviously Adobe Acrobat, which is the king of the hill and very expensive, can do it. But there are others. Mm-hmm. There's others that are less expensive. PDF Forge is a good solution, perhaps. PDF Creator. PDF Creator is open source. So in all of these, you can take any PDF. I do this all the time with forms. In fact, I think a lot of people will be doing it next month with the tax forms. You get those IRS forms as PDFs, mm-hmm. and then you use a PDF editor to fill in the fields. Some forms are designed with fields. They're actually, PDFs are designed actually to be fill-inable forms. But even a regular, just an image of any kind, if it's turned into a PDF, you can place a text field on it and type it in. So that's a simple thing to do. In fact, a good PDF tool will have a rubber stamp feature. I do this with my signature. Don't tell anybody. But when I have PDFs to sign, I'll just use the rubber stamp tool and I'll stamp my signature or initials on it. It's fast and easy. Are you on a Mac or PC?
PC.
Yeah. On the Mac, I use a really great program called PDF Creator Pro from Smile Software, and that has a rubber stamp thing. I'm being told by Dreamscapes in our chat room that the construction and design industry use something called Bluebeam, which does that. It's obviously a blueprint-focused program. I'm guessing, given that it's, vertical, that it's going to be fairly pricey, but that's something you can look into. And then there are some open source PDF. What you want is not a PDF reader. This is where some of the confusion comes in. Everybody downloads Adobe Reader to read PDFs, but you can't do that with Reader. You need something, a PDF creation tool. Acrobat's the Adobe version of that. Then the part of that is called Distiller that lets you create PDFs. But there are lots of less expensive, good choices, cute PDF.
That would allow me to create a text box on each form.
Yeah.
And then I can say, I need to put 6, 7, 8 on these 100 pages I'm going to print.
Yeah. That's why a rubber stamp would be easiest.
Right.
You can do it. Right. It's the same as what you're doing manually, physically, but you do it in the PDF creator. You create a tool, a rubber stamp with the number that you want, and then it's really easy. You open the PDF, you have the stamp tool open, you say, there's an open spot, stamp it, next one, stamp it, and you save them each out, and it's burned into the PDF. Somebody's saying Nitro Pro is inexpensive. Foxit is another very popular PDF tool. The problem with Adobe is they charge hundreds of dollars for something that should really be free, if you ask me, but this is something very simple. Bluebeam, Dreamscapes is telling me, is actually designed to do this because it will search for open space on the, it will do it more automatically. It'll say, oh, let's see where there's nothing. I'm going to put the number there. That's why architects use it.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm looking for.
Yeah, yeah, it will do it in a more automated fashion. So it depends. If you're going to do, if this is something that you're going to be doing it all the time for the in the foreseeable mm-hmm. future, it would be worth getting Bluebeam.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your help.
My pleasure. Yeah, I have. This is why, by the way, a signature is not a good way of authenticating a document, and yet that's what we do. I use Smile on my Mac's PDF. I think actually I got the name wrong. It's PDF Pen, I believe. PDF Pen Pro. And it has, among other tools, for editing and modifying PDFs. PDF stands for Portable Document Format. It's a document you can send to anybody that they can almost always read because most, Windows 10 comes with a PDF reader and creator. So does the Macintosh. And for older versions of Windows, you can download the free Adobe Reader. So it's presumed everybody can read it. And the PDFs have some advantages. It's not like a word processing document. You can't modify them. You can lock them. You can make them into fillable forms or not. But there, it's a good way to distribute a document. You don't assume anything on the part of the reader except they have a PDF reader. So they don't have to have the fonts you used in the document and things like that. So people use it a lot for documents they don't want to have changed. Blueprints would be great. And among the tools on this PDF pen and a number of other PDF editing programs is a rubber stamp, which you can, you know, if there's something you type a lot, this is okay or whatever. And I have my signature. I have family member signatures. It's very convenient. I have my initials. And so when I have a contract, for instance, and often contracts are sent to you in PDF form, you just stamp your signature on it. It looks exactly the same each time. Nobody's ever complained. That's my legal signature. I actually used a tablet to make it. So it's my legal signature. Acrobat has apparently a batch numbering solution as well. Scooter X from the chat room is telling us. So there's a lot of ways to do this. We'll put as many as we can find in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Renee, British Columbia. Hello, Renee.
Hi.
Hi.
So I'll tell you my question.
Okay.
So I have a good gaming computer that was custom built for me by a local computer shop.
Nice.
Yeah, it's about 4 years old, but it still does everything I want. It runs my games at either ultra high or high resolutions. I edit raw photos with it. It's a perfectly good computer.
Okay.
And I ran the Inspector software that you recommended on it.
Okay.
And discovered that it's vulnerable to the Spectre vulnerability.
Yeah, Steve Gibson's wonderful little tool, INSPECTRE. It's free and you can download it. And then it'll tell you if you've been patched.
Yeah, so I haven't been. And it says I need to get an update to the BIOS for the system. So I called the computer shop that built it, and they checked, and there hasn't been an update for the BIOS issued for this motherboard.
Yeah, this is a little bit of a problem with a custom-built computer. If you got it from HP, Dell, Lenovo, they're kind of taking responsibility, and they're pushing out. There tends to be they call it a firmware update in addition to any software updates. The browsers need to be updated. Microsoft's pushing those out to Windows users, and I presume you are updated for that. But if there's not a BIOS update from the, and it would come from the motherboard manufacturer. Who's the motherboard manufacturer?
It's ASUS.
Okay.
And I've been periodically, so I stopped using my computer.
Because we've scared people with this Inspector meltdown thing.
Yeah.
It's not a big deal.
I don't need
deal.
To worry?
No.
Okay. Because I've been checking periodically with the motherboard manufacturer, and it doesn't seem like they're planning to.
Yeah, if it's really old, ASUS may not update it. Don't worry about it. You keep listening. If it turns out that there's a big flaw out there, I'll let you know if there's risk. Currently, there's zero risk for end users. Zero. So don't worry about it. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Yeah, and part of this is because Intel pushed, had a fix, and then they said, oh, no, don't do that. So it's possible ASUS is working on something and it's been delayed. But given that it's 4 years old, it may be that, you know, they're not going to update everything forever. And it may be they've just decided, no.
It's just a shame because it's still a really good computer.
Yeah, keep using it. Keep using it. And do all the things you would normally do for keeping it secure. Make sure you keep it updated, all the software, keep it updated. You're much more at risk from other things. Here's the issue. In order to use this, take advantage of this, somebody would have to get some software on your system. You've probably been patched for any of the bugs that can be activated through the web in your browser. Your browser's been patched. Microsoft's fixed that. Chrome is fixed.
I do all those
Firefox
updates.
Is fixed. As long as you do those updates, you're fine. So in order for somebody to take advantage of the CPU, the BIOS level thing, they'd have to get some software on your computer. They'd have to get malware on your computer. There's no malware that we know of that does this yet. It's very hard to do. And it's of limited value. The people that really have to worry about this are people running systems that many users use, like web hosting companies and Amazon Web Services and Google Code and people, and you know, Azure, people like that, because you have 100 users with one processor, and one of them, if one of them's bad, they can snoop into the other users' processes. But you're at home alone on your computer. Somebody would have to almost certainly be targeting you. You don't have to worry about it. Just do the normal things to protect yourself.
Okay, I feel much better. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of us are running unpatched. Did you read the material Steve has in that? If you scroll down, there's more information about it.
Yeah, I did read it. And I made note that he said there needed to be an update to the BIOS.
Yeah. And so it's good to know that that's what you need. You may or may not get it at some point. ASUS may send a fix out. Keep an eye out for it. That older motherboard, you're going to have to update yourself. It's not hard to do, but that means it won't tell you. You have to check in.
Yep. Yeah, I've been checking in periodically. Yeah. And I'll take it to the shop and have them do it.
Yeah, you can do it every month. What's your game?
Oh, I play a lot of games. My current favorite is Elder Scrolls Online.
Oh, nice.
I
Me too.
Like Civilization.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And Witcher was another one I really
love.
Enjoyed.
Witcher. Been playing Witcher 3. Okay, cool.
Yeah,
Civ should do fine on that computer. You know, Civ will run forever. Witcher gets a little more challenging. I'm sure that Witcher 4 will be harder. And and Elder Scrolls, I don't think that's too demanding either, actually, especially the online version.
Since I haven't been using my gaming PC, I've been playing Elder Scrolls on my Surface Pro 4, and it runs on that just fine, so it's not too demanding.
Nice. Well, it's very nice to meet you. Thanks for calling. And, I think we've scared people unnecessarily.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
All right,
you.
Renee. Take care. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
I think we've made it sound like, you got to get it. Oh. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888 Ask Leo. I apologize. I really do. I think the tech journalism community have really scared people unnecessarily over this Spectre and Meltdown thing. So let me tell you a little bit about what I think. This is what my opinion. First of all, the program Renee mentioned is a great one to get. It's free. It's small. You download it very quickly. It doesn't install anything. So when you run it, you throw it away. But it does check your status as far as this Spectre and Meltdown issue. And it's called Inspector. And it's spelled Inspectre, not Erre. If you Google Inspector, I think the number one search result will be this little program. It's from my friend Steve Gibson. He's my security guru, grc.com. He does a show with me called Security Now. GRC is his website, grc.com. So if you want to check, because it's hard to tell, frankly. I mean, they don't put up a big sign saying, good, you're fixed. It's hard to know. But this is it's a bad bug because it affects all processors in the last 30 years. So it's bad that way. That's 22 years, sorry. It's bad in that respect. But it's a hard thing to take advantage of. The operating systems and the browsers have been patched in almost every case. Not all, but almost every case. But even if they weren't, it's a difficult exploit. There are much, much bigger things to worry about on the internet. Probably the thing to do is what I recommend anyway, which is update to the degree you're able to. And understand if you're running an older version of the operating system like Windows XP that's not being patched, or you're running an old computer, 4-year old motherboard that may or may not get patches, that you're running a little bit risky. But I understand it's hard to gauge how much risk there is. On a scale of 1 to 100, Spectre Meltdown, less than 1. Less than 1. There are much bigger problems out there. Keep yourself updated. Keep all your programs updated. Don't download files from strangers. Don't click on links in email or messaging programs. You know, I get a lot of emails now with nothing in the email except a link. Now, you'd have to be a real nut job to click that link. That's not going to be important. Even if it looks like the email came from somebody you knew, it's just the link? Yeah, don't click on that. And really only install software that you actively go get, right? And we were talking last show about don't install more software than you use. Don't be one of those software collectors, hoarders that just has to have every program. Even if for instance, you use Microsoft Office, a lot of people, they just, you know, Microsoft sets it up this way. You just install the whole thing. Are you ever going to use the Access database? If not, don't install it. Not only does it take up space, but any program you install can potentially open a door to bad guys because all programs have flaws. So why install something you don't need? Install only the programs you're going to use. And I mean, you know, I'm going to use that tomorrow. And from that point on, don't install a program until you need it. If you suddenly need a stopwatch program, okay. And then be very careful about where you get it from. Try to get your software from, you know, big companies, known companies, good companies. And don't get it from strange sites. Get it from the original company's site. You know, if it's from Microsoft, don't get it from Joe's Software Barn. Get it from Microsoft. And you don't have to worry so much about this. I think we've maybe done a little disservice by overplaying this. It's from a technical perspective a horrendous flaw. But one thing we should also point out on older machines like Renee's, if there is a patch, it's going to slow your machine down a lot. It's her gaming machine. So there's another thing you have to weigh. Is it worth slowing it down 30% for an attack that in all likelihood will never happen? Well, you have to be the judge. I'd say no. If you have a modern machine within the last year, the fixes for the Spectre and Meltdown don't slow it down appreciably. But on older machines, they do. Pre-Haswell, they really do. So be careful there. Mike in Maine. Hello, Mike.
How are you doing, Leo?
I'm very well. How are you today?
I'm doing great. This is like an old school hour, you know, malware, cloning drives, and
it is.
Now printers.
Oh, no, printers. The IT guy's bane.
Exactly. But this is actually pretty simple, I think. You know, I need to print on occasion. I think sometimes we all do 2 or 3 pages a week, maybe. And occasionally, I do need to print something in color. And my old color printer is gone because, you know, the print heads just dry up. They get clogged.
This is a real problem with inkjets. They don't work as well in a low-use scenario. They dry up, they clog, and I have the same problem. So really, for a situation like that, I'd look at a color laser. They're less expensive than you think.
Well, that was my question because, you know, there is this company, and I don't want to mention any names unless I can, that, you know, makes inkjets that use, you know, these big tanks that are a lot cheaper to use.
You mean Epson and the amazing EcoTank printers, our sponsor?
I've heard nothing but
yeah, but that's really designed for a high-duty environment, like an office or somewhere where you print a lot. A student is printing a color every day. I find inkjets, I have to say, the EcoTanks are better. My wife has an EcoTank, and it does not have the same problem as my old inkjet did. But she prints maybe a little bit more than I do. She might print every day, so maybe that's the case. So look at, but I think people should look at color laser printers. The color is office color, so it's not, you're not going to print photos with it. But for graphs and charts, you know, color printouts, you know, that kind of office style color printouts, they're fine. They're excellent.
Well, do any of the inkjet the tanks, the Epson ones or the color laser ones, would they print a disc like a DVD or with the special discs?
No, you need to get those. What do they call them? There's the special.
Well, Epson does make a printer, and that's the
but
old.
But they inkjet that. That's an inkjet on disc. That's not the etching on discs.
And that would be fine. But I didn't know if Epson made them with the new EcoTanks. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I'm not up on the complete system. I don't think they do. I think they really visualize the EcoTanks for an office setup where there's a lot of... The whole point of the EcoTank is you're using a lot of ink, right? That's the idea. So there's a lot of printing going on. I think you should look at a laser. You're right. You're not going to print on CDs. You're going to need an inkjet printer if you're going to print on CDs. But who makes CDs anymore?
Well, there are a couple of times here and there that you need to print on a CD or DVD.
I think Epson's the only one that still prints on CDs. So you're going to need your...
Epson and Canon does. And I'll probably just go with another cheap $100 Epson and then throw it away after 2 or 3 years. That's what
The Ecotanks might not be as good because you're not replacing the print head. See, that's one thing you get when you replace a cartridge. You get not only more ink, but you get a new print head. So you probably should not get an Ecotank for that kind of printing. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. That's me. Time to talk computers and the internet and, you know, home theater, digital photography, smartphones, smart watches, all that jazz. Chris Marquardt, our photo guru, coming up in about half an hour. I think it's time for our assignment. Uh-oh. Did you take pictures and submit them to the Flickr group? We'll pick three of them and talk about them on the radio. 8888-ASK-LEO. That's the phone number if you want to talk about technology. Lately, I've been MOOCing. I'm kind of excited about this. Maybe you've heard about MOOCs. What is it? Multiple online courses. Multiple something. User online courses. The idea is... That would be MOOC, but it's not. It's MOOC. The idea is a lot of universities are doing this. They're putting their courses online. If you have a iTunes U on your Mac or your iOS device, you can see courses from Stanford, and MIT has its courseware. A lot of Yale, Harvard, a lot of companies, colleges, putting these online, in many cases, completely free. And then, of course, there's the kind of the commercial MOOCs like Udacity that are courses designed specifically for Udacity. And, you know, I love this idea. I mean, even Khan Academy, a lot of high school students looking for help in difficult subjects like calculus and physics go to YouTube and they watch Khan Academy videos and they get all the help they need. And they go, wow, this is not so bad. And they excel. What I really like, though, is that kids who can't afford college can use these if they're motivated, you know, if they want to learn, they can use these and get a college education for free. I imagine in time this will become more common. Anyway, I wanted to try it out. Programming's always been a hobby of mine. You probably heard me talk about computer programming in the past. I've been doing it, for years, since I got my first computer, an Atari 400 back in the late 70s. And like a lot of people in my generation, you know, we never were trained. I didn't go to school for it. And then we banged away at it until, you know, you start a program and you bang away at it until it works, sort of, mostly. Not a good process. Not a good way to do it. Started in BASIC, learned a lot of the other languages. Actually wrote software for work and even some freeware that I gave away, open source software. Always enjoyed it. Always had a lot of fun with it. But I always felt that had I been more formally trained, I might be better at it. And I've tried myself. I bought a lot of books. In fact, I have many, many books on computer programming. I almost collect languages. It's a hobby. But usually I don't get more than five or six chapters in, and it gets too daunting, and I give up. Yeah, I know enough. And I do know enough to write quick and dirty little programs in Python and Perl and Ruby and all the trendy languages out there. Yeah, it's fun. It's a great hobby. It's like doing crossword puzzles. Or a Sudoku, you know. It's just something to keep your mind occupied. But I thought there's a book that I've been recommending to kids when they call and they say, I want to learn to program. I said, you know, there's lots of ways you can do it. There's How to Think Like a Programmer, very famous online text. There's a lot of free ways. That's what I like. You can download Python and learn that way. And that would be learning kind of how I did it back in the day, you know, just banging at it till something works. But there are better ways. There are, especially nowadays, over the years, we've become, I think, a little bit better understanding of how to write correct software. Now, frankly, I wish we were, you know, this had been implemented more widely, because one of the reasons we have so many computer viruses and exploits and problems and crashes is because people do just kind of bang on it sometimes. It's hard to get discipline in your coding. So I tell kids, you should start with a text that was designed at Rice universities, used widely in colleges and high schools around the world, called How to Design Programs. And the nice thing about it is folks who wrote it put it online. I think MIT Press publishes a hardcover of it, but they've put the entire text online, and you can go to HTDP. I think it's .org. You can Google HTDP for how to design programs and find the text. And then they teach not in some trendy language, but in a language designed for beginners. It's called Beginning Student Language, BSL. And you can download that, a program that'll do that, Windows, Mac, Linux. It's called Dr. Racket. And actually, it's a more powerful language is in there too. Racket, which is a very powerful full-time programming language. But the Beginner Student Language is nice because it doesn't have a lot to learn. You don't spend a lot of time learning a language. You spend more time learning what programming is about, how to design programs. It's a great book, and if you're a kid or somebody who's just kind of interested, maybe want to get professional about it, it's a very good starting point. And because it's all free, you can download it and you can do it in your spare time. But I get stuck around chapter 5 or 6. I give up. So I looked around and I found a course taught from the University of British Columbia, UBC, online at a site called edx.org. edx.org. EDX is a online MOOC created by Harvard and MIT, but many other universities have courses on there. And this course, Gregor Cazales teaches it. He's a very well-known professional, serious programmer and a computer science professor at University of British Columbia. They've done, I think, a great job of putting a course together. You watch videos, take quizzes, there's assignments, there's a discussion group for students. There's students all over the world taking it, which is fun. And it's free. I should get the exact name of it, shouldn't I, so that I can tell you. Let me go over to my login. It's called How to Code Simple Data. And actually, it's part of, an eight-course series that they give if you pay for it. And I think it's totally $800, something like that, if you decided. You don't have to pay for it. It's completely free. I paid for it because I want a little certificate at the end. You passed. I hope. Yeah, you get a grade and everything. But you don't have to pay. But if you do pay, and if you want to get what they call the micro masters, take all eight courses, which would probably take a good year, you get a certificate. People get hired from this. You could start knowing nothing about programming and literally teach yourself everything you need through these online courses. It's amazing. And I wish more programmers would. You know, it takes a little bit of ego or not, I guess, humility, the opposite, right? To say, well, I've been programming for 30 years, but I really need to learn how to do it right. But once you do, it's fun. You know, they have all these processes that modern, you know, professional programmers use. How to Code Simple Data, edx.org, O-R-G. You can take it for free or take a look at the Micro Masters. I don't know if I'll do that. It might be fun. Get a Micro Master's degree in computer science after all these years. It's a fun hobby. How about that? But if you're a young person or you're somebody trying to get into what I think is probably a pretty good profession these days, computer programming, this would be a great way to start. There are a lot of them, and I'm sure that we'll get a lot of people saying in our on our website, oh, how about this or how about that? And I'd love to get that. And you can go to techguylabs.com. That's free. There's no sign up. And leave your comments. Where are you studying programming? Where are you learning? What are you learning? How do you like it? I'll put my recommendation there. I'll put a link to it on the show notes, techguylabs.com. But I'd love to hear what you think. What I love is that you don't have to be able to spend $20,000 a year on a college education to get a college education. What a revolution. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Take a little tiny time out. I can think the phones are ringing. Yes, they are. Kim Schaffer's been picking them up. We'll get to your calls next. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. 8888. Ask Leo. Line 4, Cheryl, you're Belinda, California. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi, Leo.
Hello.
Nice to talk to you. I have a choice between two phones. I can't afford a real expensive phone, so one of them is a Motorola G5 Plus.
Love it.
I thought you would because you recommended the G4, so.
Love it. What's your other choice?
My other choice is my sister's old 5-year-old Samsung Galaxy Note 2 that she just gave me if I want it.
That's nice. That's free.
It is free, but the it uses KitKat, and that's so old. And
it's really, really old. And the problem with, as bad as old computers are, old phones are worse.
Oh.
And I'll tell you why. Not that they're wear out. And it's kind of sad. I mean, the phone is going to be exactly as good as it was the day she got it. But operating systems make big advances, particularly in security. That's an Android device. And unfortunately, you can't put a modern version of Android on there. My guess is you probably can't get any later than Android 4.0 or 4.1.
No, I looked and it can't be, upgraded. It's too old.
So we're currently at 8. And more importantly, Google now pushes out monthly security updates, kind of like Microsoft does for Windows, and you won't be able to take advantage of those. So I don't, you would on the Moto, but not on the Samsung. And so while that Note 2 is a nice phone, I wouldn't say no to it, but you're really going to get a much faster, better, but more importantly, more secure phone with a G5 Plus.
Okay. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome. I know I'm spending money instead of saving you money, but it's going to be, you'll be so much happier, I think. The camera's better. It's running a modern version of Android. It's getting the Android security updates. Motorola has done a fabulous job. Really nice.
Well, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
I love your show.
Oh, thank you for calling, Cheryl. I really appreciate it. Oh, gosh. Joe, Covina, California. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Yes. Hi,
Joe.
Leo.
Hey.
I have an old Windows 7 computer that I put an SSD on it, a 500 gigabyte, and I've been using it, and I'm having periodic problems with it, though. And the main one is the trackpad occasionally goes out, and I have to use an external mouse, which does work, a USB external mouse.
That would be my suggestion. Yeah, trackpads wear out. How old is old?
Well, it's pretty old.
Windows 7 came out in 2009, so could it literally be almost 10 years old, and that would be pretty old. I mean, you could, you're keeping it up to date, I presume. You've got the latest drivers for the trackpad and so forth.
Oh, sure. In fact, I can't even get Windows 7 stuff anymore from HP because it says this computer is too old.
Wow. That's surprising. Thanks, HP. Microsoft still sends out updates. I guess HP decides not to pass them along or something. It may be, you'll have to search online, maybe go to ifixit.com. It may be possible to swap. The trackpads are basically a standalone USB device. They're just built into that wrist rest there. And some computers, you can open it up, take it out, put in a new one. So if you want to restore it, but before you even consider it, I would search around for that particular model and see if anybody's got a video online on how to do it. iFixit often has videos on these kinds of things. But otherwise, look on YouTube. There's videos that take almost anything apart on YouTube.
But my main question was, since it's only does it periodically, it goes out and comes back, and lately it's been going out more often. Is that a hardware thing?
That's a hardware thing for sure. Software doesn't come and go like that. Hardware does.
Okay, now one other quick question about the same thing, the same computer anyway. Since I put the SSD in it, the buttons on the top, on the FN keys, on the function keys that control the volume and the brightness, no longer appear on the screen, but they do their function. They just don't show me what they're doing.
Yeah, that's probably an update to Windows 7. I don't remember that happening. Or maybe HP put those on. That's not a typical operation to have to show on screen. So that was something maybe you added or something HP added that is no longer there or is no longer working. Not familiar with that particular thing. There might be software you could add to do that. I would look at stardock.com. They make a lot of Windows add-ons, and maybe they have an add-on like that. They might even have a free add-on like that. Anybody know? This is an 8-year-old HP laptop. I don't remember on-screen It's HP. Okay. So that's an HP thing. You could go to HP, get whatever updates you can. It may be that, I mean, HP said we're not updating it. It may be that they're no longer supporting it with whatever the current version of Windows 7 is. It's not unusual. Companies, after a while, they say, well, we don't want to keep that one up to date. You should just buy a new one. Somebody else is saying, and this is a good idea, go to the HP forums. A lot of times people support each other when the company won't. And if the company's nice, they'll let them do it on their forums. There are companies, Apple's one of them, that if you have problems and you go to the Apple support forums and start complaining, Apple will delete your complaint. They don't want to hear it. But HP's pretty good about letting people help themselves. So try the HP forums. Make sure you have all the latest software from HP. That's a little HP add-on. I'm not familiar with it. It shows that on screen. And I'm almost certain, you know, trackpads are, you bang on them, right? I mean, they're going to go. They wear out. You may be able to replace it. It's almost certainly not software related. 8888 Ask Leo. That's the phone number. 888-827-5536. We put everything I talk about, links and so forth, up on those show notes. In fact, you know, there's more than I talk about at techguylabs.com. There's no sign up for it. It's free. But because people can comment, I think a lot of people add, you know, additional information. You certainly encourage you to do so. No need to yell at me on the radio. I can't hear you anyway. Just go to techguylabs.com. And we divide the website up into shows. This is episode 1468. So you can go right to that show. And then we divide each show up into hours and each hour up into sections, you know, comments, my comments or a caller's question. You can read, not exactly a transcript, but a summary of the caller's question and my answer. But afterwards, you know, and by tomorrow, we'll have audio and video from the show there as well. So you can actually watch or listen to the call and my answer. And then, as I said, your comments are really helpful. We appreciate that. It's a great search. All free. TechGuyLabs.com. Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, right after this. There's no greens of summer here. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, would go to the Viewfinder Villa, where Chris Marquardt, our photo guy, lurks. He's about to head to the Arctic.
Again.
Crazy man. He's going to get on this.
Got an opportunity.
Two-masted schooner to Svalbard.
Yep.
And so we won't see you for a few weeks.
Yeah, I apologize. That's one of the side effects of me being so crazy to go on a ship for
awesome.
A couple of weeks to go on the open sea between northern Norway, between Tromsø and Longyearbyen on Svalbard.
That's nuts. You're nuts. What are you doing? Anyway.
Sort of nuts. No, hanging out with friends. You know, having a good time. It's not even like a photo tour. This is just an opportunity that came up that I couldn't pass on.
I know you did a photo tour on this ship. Are you going to do another one in the future?
Possibly. It's always a risk. You know, you have to, the only way to make this work is to charter the entire thing.
Wow.
And then at that moment, you have a huge financial risk.
How many people do you need?
Well, the ship holds 20 people in 10 cabins. So, that's definitely doable. And I'm looking at possibly doing that again in the future because it was just such an amazing trip and such an amazing, you know, the camaraderie on board because you have, it's your ship and there's a crew of five and wonderful food and everything. And it's all very, you have to get close because you're spending time on that ship for 10, 12 days. So it's wonderful. It's great. It's absolutely an extraordinary experience.
Well, if you decide to do it again, let me know the date so I can book ahead. Because I book a year ahead for vacations these days.
I know. And but this is about the time that you have to plan for something like this.
Yeah.
As someone who organizes that, because those ships are usually sold like a year in advance anyway.
If you want to go on a photography workshop with Chris, he does a bunch of them, and you can find more at discoverthetopfloor.com. Discoverthetopfloor.com. Now it's time for our photo review. Remind me, what were we looking for?
We had an assignment titled Repeat. So people were sending in, things that repeat in some way or that signify that. And I have again chosen three pictures to review.
This first one, amazing.
That's an amazing photo, right?
A real winner, I think, yeah.
It's the Blue Angels in the air, but it's not just like one airplane. It's two airplanes, and they one flying upside down right behind the other one, which makes it
looks
look
like a reflection.
It's mirrored.
Yeah.
It looks like a reflection on a lake or something.
Except that one's number four and one's number five. That is a stunning photo. Not to mention they're traveling 400 miles an hour at 1,000 feet up. I don't even know how he got this photo.
Well, it wasn't even super sophisticated equipment. I mean, Nikon D500, a 200 to 500 millimeter lens. Well, it's decent equipment for sure. But
you can read the name of the pilot on the side of the plane. It's amazing.
It is an amazing photo. It's great timing. It's the right location.
Rain photo, R-E-I-G-N photo. I ought to give him credit for this because that's really
nice. Definitely. Yeah. So, repeat for sure. It's a symmetry of sorts, and I like that.
I got the numbers on the tail wrong because one's upside down. It's 5 and 7. Okay.
5 and 7.
Not 5 and 4. 5 and 7.
Yep. The second one is by Gregches 2000 with the wonderful title IMG_12474 tiff.jpg. Anyway, it's a bunch of discs. And it's light, and what it does to raindrops on a window, if you're very close and if you focus to the distance, it's pretty much some inverted bokeh. You know, bokeh is when normally it's behind your subject, and this one is in front of it. And it makes, with the specific combination of that lens and the light, the point light source in the background, creates this weird-looking kind of bokeh. And I think Gretsch's 2000 did also increase the contrast on that and just gave it a bit of more of a gritty look. It's an interesting look. It's very abstract, but it's definitely something that made me stop and look.
That's beautiful.
I liked it a lot.
Yeah. It is completely abstract. It looks like it could be cells. It could be anything. Yeah.
Well, the only way I found out that it's raindrops on a window is because I read the comments and he put that in there. So... Yeah, I'm not smart enough to guess that. Last picture, C. Bowser, Idle Hands is the title. And we're looking at a black and white photo with some light shining on a wall. There's a hand. It's mostly in the shadow and some light hits the hand. But then at the same time, the shadows that you show are also of a hand. So you have kind of two hands touching, but one is real. One is the shadow. There's some interesting light effects going on there, and the whole thing again, it's hard to explain, but it just moved something in me. It just touched me in some way. It evoked an emotional reaction without being very descriptive or anything. So that's what I like about it. It kind of hit me in a spot that I'm not sure why that's happening.
You know, this was a good assignment. I think repeat was abstract enough that we got some kind of abstract and very interesting images.
Yes.
Yeah. Really, really worked out well. Thank you to all of you who participated. Thanks to Renee Silverman, too, who runs the Tech Guy group on Flickr.
By the way, that last photo was taken with a smartphone, so
what?
It doesn't even take an amazing camera. No.
It's really, I think this is really just an excuse to get you outside and taking pictures. Now, Chris is going to be gone for 3 weeks, so you're going to have a month to take some pictures. And when he gets back, we'll have the review. But, Chris, it's on your shoulders. You have to pick the subject.
Oh, I will. The subject for the next assignment is angle.
Angle.
Angle. A-N-G-L-E.
Not angel.
And
angle. Okay. That's another abstract one. I'm expecting some very interesting photos.
You can interpret this in very abstract ways. Yes,
yes,
for sure.
Yeah. Oh, you could also be very concrete with it. So here's how it works. Just take a picture. Again, it doesn't have to be a fancy camera at all. Just somehow illustrating the idea, the concept, the word angle, whatever that means to you. We don't tell you. And then take that picture and upload it to Flickr, which is Yahoo's free photo sharing site, flickr.com. If you're not already a member, I bet you are, but if you're not, it's well worth joining. There's a nice community of photographers there. And then in the tags, because you can tag your photos, put the word A-N-G-L-E. So we know that's a submission for this assignment, and then submit it to the Tech Guy group. You'll know you're in the Tech Guy group when you see, what is it, like 12,000 members. It's the
A lot.
It's the big, we're the big group.
Almost 13,000 members at this point. Almost 6,000 photos and 250 discussion threads. Nice. I mean, this is a really active group.
Yeah.
Wonderful community there.
And Renee Silverman, who is our moderator, is doing a phenomenal job. And she will, when you send the picture over, you know, submit it, she'll say thank you and let you know we got it. And then you could do as many as one a week, so you got a chance to do four here, I think, between now and our assignment review, and have fun. You know, by the way, visit the photo pool there because there's so many great pictures. There's so many.
Yeah, there's more than just the assignments there.
Yeah, yeah. Renee does little weekly assignments and so forth too. So it's a nice group. All the details at flickr.com. Go to the Tech Guy group. Renee, thank you for doing that. Thank you, Chris Marquardt. Have a wonderful time. Don't fall off the boat.
I'll make sure to bring back stories and pictures.
Pictures. We need pictures.
As usual.
And we will catch you in about 3 weeks, 3 or 4 weeks. Discover the top 4.com, folks.
April.
All right. Have fun. Have a great March, I guess.
Thank you.
Go to discoverthetopfloor.com to find out more about what Chris is up to. He's got great books, lectures, and, of course, many beautiful photos. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. More of your calls right after this. Thank you, Christopher. Have a great time.
Quick one. When exactly will you be gone? Because I might be at the West Coast sometime in May.
I'll be back May 5th.
I will hold a workshop in New York together with Canon.
No fun.
In the second week of May.
Oh, yeah, we'll be back by then.
There's still some... I'm still looking for a few things, and there's a chance I will be on the West Coast. So,
well, let me know.
You know early enough.
Good, good. Have a great trip. I'm so jealous.
Thank you.
That sounds wonderful.
And
yeah.
See you in 3 weeks.
Take care, Chris. Bye bye.
Take care. Bye now.
Oh, you know, calling all photographers, this would be a good time to tell you about Fracture, wouldn't it? Fracture is amazing. It's a photo decor company that takes the pictures that you have, that you've taken, beautiful images. And prints them on glass for you to display. The problem is, you know, we all have great photos, but they're sitting on a hard drive somewhere or they're in a digital cloud somewhere. And, when do you see them? If you don't put your photos on the wall, I have to say, this is something my wife got me into, and now it's just kind of part of the ritual. When we get back from a trip or an event, we figure out what we're going to print, and we put them up on the wall. And when we print them on glass with Fracture. This is the biggest size. I'm going to show you the biggest one first. This is a picture I took this past spring of a seal and a flightless cormorant in battle. It's 21 by 6 by 28.8. 21.6 by 28.8. It's suitable for putting over your mantelpiece. But when you have a great picture, you want to print it big. Now, these all come ready to hang. See, it's got the hanging hardware right on it. I'll show you the smallest one they offer. This is more like a 4x5. It's actually 4.8 by 6.4. There you go. That's a 8th grade graduation. Michael and his best buddies. It comes really nicely in this, in this cardboard insert. Low packaging, even though it's glass, perfectly transported. And then you pop it out from that, and the screw is in the backing, and then there's a little hole there, so it's very easy to hang up on the wall. Actually, I tell you what we do. We put a molding along there, and then we prop it up on the molding. That makes it easy to change, although we could easily hang these. They're just beautiful. Something about printing on glass, it pops the contrast, the color. I do a lot of black and white. I'll show you. This was one I got done for Christmas a couple of years ago for everybody in the family. That's my son and daughter at his high school graduation. And it just came out. I had printed it a little bit in sepia anyway, kind of. And it just comes out so nicely on glass. If you've got great images, don't let them languish on the hard drive. Go to fracture.me and get them printed on glass at their amazing carbon neutral factory in Gainesville, Florida. They use U.S. source materials. You're going to bring a special memory to life. It's a wonderful gift. And it's a great home decor feature. We have beautiful glass prints all over our house. Thank you, Fracture. Use the offer code TechGuy15 at checkout. You'll get 15% off your first order. So if you haven't tried them, now's a good time. F-R-A-C-T-U-R-E, fracture.me, and use the offer code TechGuy15 for 15% off your first order. When you print them on glass, they just, they're alive. Fracture.me, offer code TechGuy15, and we thank Fracture for their support of the Tech Guy podcast. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Let's go. Back to the phones. Line one, Bruce, Villa Park, California. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, Leo. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks so much for calling. What can I do for you today?
Hey, we own a Western Digital Sentinel 4000, a DX4000.
Okay.
And it's connected. It's a remote drive that connects to our home network. And I got an error message called zero XD9. And it basically doesn't come on. We've got obviously all of our family pictures and important things on that hard drive. It does have redundancy to it.
Do they? That's too bad. This is their network attached storage. And that means it is a large hard drive. Actually, it's more than one hard drive. It's a large array of hard drives.
I think we have four terabyte drives on it.
Yeah. And wow, that's a lot of storage. That's amazing. And it's it doesn't have its own keyboard, mouse, or monitor. It's a computer, but it's just hooked up to the network. And it shows up as a network drive on all your computers. You can use it for backup. You can use it for media playback. A lot of different things you can do with it. So let me ask you, there must be, Western Digital must provide software with this, right, that you run on your computer?
Well, I obviously researched the error message on the internet. And
so they don't have they don't have a dashboard or anything that would tell you what's going on in there?
They have software, but believe it or not, I don't know how to use it.
Okay.
So I think it's outside my skill set to really... I'm just afraid, since the information on the drive is so important, I'm afraid to screw around with it.
Well, here's the good news. Because it's redundant, you're probably all right. It's using RAID. So what Western Digital says is OXD9 is startup failed. It occurs when the RAID volume or the boot partition is corrupted. That's not good.
That's what I thought.
They suggest you reboot. And then they say, if this does not resolve the issue, the RAID volume is corrupt and needs to be recreated. Now, that is really not good, because it means you'll have to erase everything that's on the drive.
Right.
That's really not good. And it's very disappointing. And it's a strong warning to anybody who's considering a Western Digital NAS not to get one. I don't recommend them. I don't know what you can do at this point. You can't see it, right? You can't start it up.
Well, I did take it to someone, and they did a level one test, and it didn't reveal anything. So I'm doing a more extensive level two test. But one thing he did discover is that the error message occurred with all the hard drives pulled out of the machine. So,
oh, that's good news.
Yes, I thought so too. And he thought that it was an indication that maybe it's just the hardware box itself.
Maybe.
That all the drives are contained in.
Maybe. It also may mean that you get this error message when there's nothing to boot at all. Right.
Yeah.
So it may not be encouraging, but it may be encouraging. Here's the problem. RAID, when you're using RAID and you're using those four drives in a RAID array, they're all dependent on each other. And if the RAID array fails, it's not like you can say, oh, let's see what's on this drive. It's spread out all over all the drives. One of the reasons you use RAID is so that one disk can die and you might still have your data. This is why I was asking about the dashboard. I'm sure they offer software that you run on your computer. Any system like this ought to. And that would tell you the health of your system and would warn you, for instance, if a drive dies. Now, what may have happened is a drive may have died, and because it's redundant, your system continues running, but that should give you a big red light, big honking red light that says you have to replace drive 3, because if another drive fails, you're out of luck. And what I fear, what
I fear, for all four to fail, correct?
No, that's not what's happened. But what I fear is that because you weren't running the dashboard, you didn't know that one of the drives had failed maybe months ago, maybe a year ago, and a second drive failed. And at that point, you're in trouble. Now, that's one possibility. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that it's just the boot sector, that everything else is fine. But typically with RAID, you need that hardware to work to recover your drives. I think this would be a case where calling Western Digital would be a great idea. This is so old, it's no longer in active support. But somebody in the chat room says happened to a friend of theirs, Western Digital was able to help. One way to fix this would be to get a second enclosure, another right. one of these, and put the drives into it. And if right. you had a DX4000 that's identical to the original, put the drives into it, and it worked, then it would mean that the enclosure has failed, and the right. drives and the data would be fine. But the only way to do that is to get another exact right. model DX4000. Okay. This is not ideal. And I think sometimes people think, well, I'm backing up to a NAS. I'm done. And a NAS can fail, right? It did.
Obviously,
you need more than one copy of a backup. So, and I'm hoping that you have the originals. No? It's all stored on the NAS?
I have some backup. It's exactly current, but I have some.
Yeah. So that is a problem because you don't have a backup, in other words. And just because something's RAID doesn't mean it's not going to fail. It can totally fail.
So let's say all things fail in the recovery. What do I do?
That's thousands and thousands of dollars, and not guaranteed. The cheapest thing to do would be to get another WD Sentinel DX4000. Now you can't buy them, so you're going to have to rely on eBay, or maybe I would first call Western Digital. And because if you can get a duplicate enclosure, you can at least see if the drives are okay. Maybe the drives are fine, in which case you can pull all the data off and you can send it back to them.
Right.
Some of these hardware drive recovery companies, the reason that they are so expensive, the reason they work is they keep all this stuff. They have parts for every kind of possible enclosure and drive and everything. So there are some things you might do. It's risky to do anything because you don't want to do something that's going to take a working drive and corrupt it.
Right.
So depending on how desperate you are, the best thing to do would be to go on eBay and buy a WD Sentinel DX4000.
Right.
You'd probably get it cheap. And then put all the drives in the same order in there and hope it boots.
Clear the decks and get out of this problem. What do you suggest going forward as a better alternative?
Well, I recommend Synology NASes, Synology, but you'd be in the same boat if you don't have a backup. Sometimes people think, well, it's on a backup drive, it's backed up. No, it's only a backup if you have two or more copies of it, right? You have the original and what's on the WD, then you have a backup. But if the WD is where you're putting everything and it's not backed up, you don't have a backup. So no matter what you do, there are better NAS solutions. I understand why you did this. Great. This is convenient. I use a big NAS just like that, and everything's backed up to it. But one of the things I do is I make sure it's backed up as well. So that's fairly important. If you don't have ideally, you have more than two copies of everything. The way I do it, I have a documents folder. It's several terabytes of stuff that I – actually, several – 100 gigabytes, not even that big, of stuff that I have to have. I have about a terabyte of photos and that. The photos I have duplicating to a NAS. It's a Synology NAS. This Western Digital would have been fine, but it's duplicating a Synology NAS. But I don't delete the originals. The originals are on another drive, and then I back it up to another drive. So I have multiple copies, and always one of them should be off-site. So I have all my photos here as well. Same thing with that special 200 gigabyte documents folder. It's on this computer here. It's on the NAS at home. It's on several computers at home. It's backed up everywhere. That's the, or use Carbonite, our sponsor. That's the only way you're not going to lose something is if you have multiple copies and one of them should be offsite. The other thing from now on you must do this, another reason I don't like the WD. Really, WD is a hard drive manufacturer. The NAS is just a way to sell more hard drives. They're not committed to a network attached storage device. It's not a great one. There are much better NASAs out there. They're more expensive. A good NAS will have a dashboard you run on one of the computers that keeps you up to date on the status of the NAS. How are the hard drives? And will alert you. You want to see a big old pop-up on your screen if one of the drives starts to fail. That's really important. The WD, I gather, you have to log into through a browser. You know, if your WD's not working, that's not helpful. But in future, if you get one of these, do keep an eye on it. Every week or so, check the status, the health. Make sure your drives are okay. I think the best bet at this point is to hope that it's the enclosure that's failed, not the drives. See if another enclosure fixes it. You can get an old used one probably fairly cheaply on eBay. If that doesn't work, then bring it to a drive recovery person and see if they can get it recovered. That's going to be a lot harder because it's a RAID array. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Explaining how to use SpinRite in a situation like this is not probably what I would do. You could, if you had the resources, and a recovery person would, and that's why I said bring it to a recovery person, they will do what's appropriate. Certainly SpinRite would be an interesting choice. It's not the first choice. I'd first choice would be see if hope that it's the enclosure that's failed. If it's not, if one of the drives has failed, perhaps SpinRite will help it. But in order to do that, you have to one by one pull the drives and SpinRite them, and you have to make sure you don't corrupt the data in that process. SpinRiting four terabyte drives is going to be a long time and not even close to guaranteeing a fix. So it's not, you know, I only have a few minutes with each caller, so it's not the first thing I'd recommend. Yeah, got enough coffee for an army here. 52 ounces of steaming hot coffee. Yeah, if a RAID fails, that's bad. Here's why SpinRite might not help that. I mean, what if it, okay, bad sectors, it relocates the sectors. That doesn't guarantee, that may break the RAID. Might not, but yeah, it's, the level one, level two makes me think that the recovery guy did run SpinRite on it. I don't know. I mean, I don't know what he's otherwise what he'd be talking about. Yeah, when you buy this, you buy it populated. I'm almost certain that he bought this from Western Digital populated. I don't know what they populate it with, but I would bet you to keep the price down. It's not their special super duper drives. Never get a NAS solution from a company that makes hard drives. Lon, I don't think he put drives in it at all. I'm sure he bought it populated, probably with WD Blues, but who knows, right? They put red in? Okay, that would be the right one to put in a NAS, right? The reds? Well, hey, how are you today? Leo Laporte here, the tech guy. Oh, yeah, time to talk computers and the internet and home theater and digital photography and smartphones and smart watches and backing your data up, for crying out loud. 8888. Ask Leo, the phone number, 888-827-5536. NAS storage, we were talking about last hour, network attached storage, is it's kind of an advanced topic in computing, but it's actually incredibly convenient. The idea is somewhere in a closet or somewhere, since we all have networks now, right? So, I mean, who would have thought that? We all got basically what used to be exclusively the province of a business in our house. Routers and switches and networks and cabling and all that stuff. Since we all have networks, or most of us, it makes sense, since we have also multiple devices, laptops, maybe some tablets, maybe some phones, desktops. I mean, you need to have both of those to make this make any sense. But if you have a LAN, if you have a network and you have many devices, it makes sense then to have a central big storage device that you can use to put things on, whether it's backups, photos, media files that you want to be available everywhere, or any file you want it to be available to every computer on the network. And that's what a network attached storage is, just a honking big drive. It's really a computer. I mean, it has an operating system. It has processors and memory and all that stuff. But you stick it in the closet. It doesn't have a monitor or a keyboard or a mouse. It's just attached to the network. Now, you're probably going to have it be somewhere near your Wi-Fi access point or your router, because it should be wired in. In fact, a number of companies make routers with hard drives in them. Generally, I think that's okay. I don't think it's as good as a real professional network attached storage. We'll have multiple drives. It'll have a very fast processor in it. Most routers do not. It'll have a considerable amount of memory in it. Most processors, routers do not. So you want something that's a little heavier duty. Now, of course, that means you're going to spend a lot of money. It's going to cost as much as a computer. And you're going to spend money on storage, on drives in there. It also means, you know, you need to have a good operating system on it that does the things you need it to do. If it's a media server or backup device, some NAS devices will actually reach out to the computers they're connected to and actually back them up automatically. That's a nice feature. Many will back up to the cloud as well. That's a really nice feature, so that you have some sort of off-site backup of this, because you're relying on this NAS. And while they're generally very reliable, they also are, everything's on there, that they're pretty vital. So you want, you know, some NAS solutions. The one I use and recommend, I really like, called Synology. If you're willing to spend the money, you can set up a duplicate Synology at work, at home and at work, and have them synchronize so that you've got two copies, one at work, one at home, of everything. That's nice. And, you know, you can run the Plex server on there, for an example, or the iTunes media server or Windows media server, and you can connect a device to your TV that can see the NAS and play movies, so you can store movies on it. There are a lot of different uses for it. It's a little more advanced, a little bit expensive, but it's a nice thing to have. And my NAS basically takes the place of a number of cloud solutions like Google Drive, like Evernote Notes, Dropbox. I do that all locally, so I don't have to put private information out on the public internet. I like that as well. As I said, I like Synology, but there are many companies that make NASs. And a number of people who, you know, if you're really a geek, you might take an old computer, put more hard drives in, it's best if it's a tower case, and run network-attached software. There's something called FreeNAS, for instance, a Linux distribution designed for network-attached storage devices. But that's a black diamond tip for people who are fairly sophisticated. Now, let's go to Fred in Columbia, Maryland. Hello, Fred.
Hi, how are you? My goodness, I'm surprised I was able to reach you.
Well, it's
an 86-year-old Korean War veteran who's been into computers for quite a while. I'm a retired pharmacist, but I'm legally blind. I have macular degeneration, and the VA has provided me with a lot of devices. But also, I belong to a low vision group where I go and suggest things they can use. At home, I use an Amazon Echo, and I use Siri on an iPad, and I use Siri on an iPhone, which is all by voice command. And I wanted to know if you have any other suggestions that I can pass on to these people in the low vision groups that I do talks to all the time.
Well, Fred,
it would be helpful to them.
It's such an honor to meet you, and thank you for calling. I'm thrilled that you did get through.
I've been listening to you for years. I listened to you on a podcast right now, and I finally got your phone number. I could never remember it. I was just listening to a podcast from the 28th, but I'm not listening to you directly, but I'm talking to you now, and this is a great...
Well, Fred, I'll tell you what. You ask your question now, and you'll get your answer on the podcast in a couple of weeks. Won't that be great?
That would be...
All right, Fred. You actually nailed it right off the top, because I agree. These voice services, whether it's the Echo or Siri, Google's Assistant, these are great. Now, don't forget the Google Assistant, because it depends on what people are doing. And I think if you just want music, the Amazon Echo is great. If you've got home automation, lights you want to turn on, or garage doors you want to open, the Echo is great. But for true information, the Google Home is a wonderful device, because it's tied to Google's search. And so it seems to be better with facts. In fact, I was thinking, let me ask it. Hey, Google, who's going to win the Oscar tonight for Best Picture? See if it knows.
It's impossible for me to pick against a movie about sharing information with the world. So I have to predict the post for Best Picture.
Look at that. It actually knows who's going to win Best Picture.
Who did it pick?
It picked the post. Now, you'll have to tell me when you listen to the podcast if it was right, okay?
Okay, I'll do that. I am going to get an Android device. I was thinking about it for myself. I do listen to a lot of jazz, so I have it hooked up through my stereo system.
Isn't that
one of
nice?
My Echo.
Yes, I do that too. It's really nice. Yeah, and I would, you know, the Google has Echo-like devices. The Google Dot is very affordable. It's the size of a donut. They even have one that's pink. It looks kind of like a jelly donut. And it's about $40-$50. So it's very affordable. It's like the Echo Dot. It's called the Google Home Mini. They have a Google Home MIDI. They just call it the Google Home. It's about this, a little smaller than an Echo. It looks like an air freshener. And they even have the Google, if you like music, they have the Google Home Max, which is actually a very nice music speaker. It's a large music speaker. But I would look at Android devices too. In fact, the Google Pixel, which is the Android device from Google, has a feature I think would be great for people with low vision. If you squeeze it, if you squeeze the sides, it launches the Google Assistant, and you can talk to the Google Assistant. So it's a very, it gives you a little vibration back. It's a very easy thing to do. I need to take a break, Fred, for the advertisers, but I'm going to encourage anybody listening. We've got some more suggestions for people with low vision. I think computers would be challenging, although I have a friend with macular degeneration who just sets his screen size to, you know, very small, probably 10. Let's see, what is he? I think 640 by 480, which makes things bigger. And then he makes the text size even bigger. And he can actually read his screen pretty well. I've seen him do amazing things reading his screen with everything set extra large. So a good computer like a Mac or a Windows PC, those have, of course, magnifying capabilities, things like that. Any other suggestions? Tablets, that might be a little bit more challenging, a little harder to use. 8888, ask Leo. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. We'll keep taking your calls right after this. Thanks, Fred. Who's nominated for an Oscar tonight?
My apologies. Yeah. I don't understand.
Who are the Best Picture nominees?
The nine nominees for Best Picture are The Post, Lady Bird, Get Out, Dunkirk, Darkest Hour, The Shape of Water, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, Phantom Thread, and Call Me by Your Name.
My name? Okay. Does it know who are the Best Actor nominees?
The five nominees for Best Actor are Denzel Washington, Timothée Chalamet, Daniel Kaluuya, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Gary Oldman.
Nice. They taught him how to pronounce Chalamet. I'm sorry. With the echo, I always have it, use an alternate trigger word, but I can't do that, unfortunately, with Google Home. So I apologize. Leo Laporte, the tech guy, 8888, ask Leo the phone number. Jonathan, I'm not sure where he's calling from, but he's on the line right now. Where are you calling from, Jonathan?
Long Beach, California.
Hi, Jonathan. What can I do for you?
Hey. Well, you know what? I have found out I save my movies that I purchased on DVD, and I put it on a hard drive. But it's a Western Digital hard drive. I bought it 6 months ago off of Amazon. And on the desktop, it just says WD Smartware. And I don't know. Does that mean it's gone?
Your question number two for the day on failing Western Digital hard drives. You can't. It's a USB drive.
Yes, USB.
And if you unplug it, is it on Windows you're using this?
It's on a Mac.
It's on a Mac. If you unplug it, does the Mac complain when you unplug it? Does it say, hey, you didn't eject that?
No, when I plug it in, I've been afraid to.
It's okay to unplug it. It's okay if you're not writing to it to unplug it. The reason I ask is sometimes the Mac won't show you the drive, but if you unplug it and it complains that you removed it without ejecting it, at least it knows it's there.
Yeah, sometimes it'll say it needs to be initialized, but then
So it sounds like a flaky interface. So when it says needs to be initialized, it can't read it, but then it comes up other times and you can read it, right?
No, the icon itself doesn't come up. Anymore.
It never comes up at all.
Well, it used to come up. I mean, it's not that old. I mean, it's only 6 months old. So why would it fail at 6 months old? It's a 6 terabyte hard drive.
Oh my God! It must be two drives together, right? 6 terabytes. Wow.
No. It's a lot because I keep a lot of movies on. I figured it's better to, you buy a movie and put it on a shelf and collect dust. This way, your friends, you don't have to go looking for it. You just do it. But I'm just wondering, is it the software? Is it a software thing or hardware?
Well, we don't have enough information to know that at this point. One way to kind of so here's what could go wrong. It's an external hard drive that connects to your computer via a USB interface. The drive could be dead. The drive could be hard to read. The USB interface in the box could be failing or shorted out. The cable could be bad. Your USB port could be bad. The computer's USB drivers could be bad. The drive could be connecting, loading, but not showing up because software is confused about what's on the drive. There's many, that's not even a complete list. Many things could be wrong. So we're going to have to kind of break it down a little diagnostically. That's why unplugging the drive and plugging it back in, that's certainly the first thing to try. Maybe plug it into a different USB port if you have one. If you're plugging it into a hub, not directly into the computer, plug it in directly to the computer. Could be the hub isn't giving it what it needs. Make sure if it's a powered drive that it's getting power and that the power supply is working. That's another area of failure. Apples have a disk utility. It's stored in the applications folder, in the utilities folder. I would open the disk utility and see if you can see the drive. Sometimes you'll be able to see the drive physically attached, but the drive contents won't be visible. That would be an indicator that the drive interface is working. It's mounting and USB is seeing it, but what's on the drive is no longer legible. And that means that's actually your worst case scenario. It could mean that the drive itself is either failing or the formatting is failing. Even with drives, failures can be a large variety of problems. It could be that the drive itself has all of your data on it, is just fine, but just the table of contents, in effect, the table that tells the drive where files are, is damaged. If that gets damaged, your drive will have all the data, but it just can't find it. It's like the card catalog disappeared. There's so many other things that can go wrong. And the truth is, these giant drives are much more vulnerable. That drive isn't any bigger than a terabyte drive, right? But it stores six times the data. Why is that? The data is very tightly packed. And they're doing all sorts of magic, error correction and things like that, to make it reliable. But it's still hanging by a thin thread. So those giant drives like that, those, to me, may be too big. You'd be better off to get a drive array that combines multiple drives with RAID, something like that, and some redundancy. That way, if one of the drives fails, you're not out of luck. So it's very hard for me to tell what's wrong with the drive. I would run disk utility and see if you can see the drive. Try plugging in, as I said, I don't want to repeat myself. I won't go through that whole litany again. You can rewind the tape if you want to hear it again. We'll put this step-by-step in the show notes at techguylabs.com. Any other things we can think of? You know, there are drive recovery utilities, but I wouldn't jump to that. And often the fact that it's a USB drive means it's hard to run those utilities because USB kind of hides the internals of the disk from the operating system. You almost have to take the drive out and connect it directly to run some of these tools on it. Most of them are for Windows anyway. Yeah, it could have failed. I hope you had a backup. That's the other side of it. Drives die. Some wag in the chat room said earlier, all drives are dying. It's just a matter of how soon. It's really true. 8888 Ask Leo. That is my phone number. We'll put kind of a step-by-step diagnostic as best we can up on the website, techguylabs.com. This is one of those things where as much as logic helps, a little intuition goes a long way to helping you fix these problems, hard drive problems. Like, what do you think is wrong? Is the fan spinning? Is the thing getting really hot? Did you hear a clunking sound coming out of the hard drive before it failed? You know, your intuition will help you guide you in the right direction. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Hey, what you got to say? Leo Laporte, the tech guy. That's what I have to say. 8888 Ask Leo, the phone number. Dave, Lake Tahoe, California. Hello, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Leo. Great show. A lot of good information all the time. Long time listener. But, hey, my Dell XPS is nearly 10 years old, and I'm I upgraded it a few years ago to Windows 7 with more RAM, but I ran into a problem with the Windows 10. It had to revert back to 7. It hung up and wouldn't take the low.
Couldn't do it.
The upgrade.
Couldn't do it.
No. But anyways, I'm a tablet guy. I'm on my Apple iPad all the time, and maybe 10% on the laptop or the desktop. But I he needs a desktop for doing some Excel and Microsoft Word and stuff like that occasionally. But I figured out, I go, you know what, I can figure out how much I'm using. I went to the event log and find out, you know, that I use the event log to kind of track. So I'm using it about 10 hours a month, roughly.
A very light use. Very light use. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Well, there are a couple of things you can. A couple of things you could do. I mean. Yeah, I'm not. You know, a 10-year-old computer is pretty old, especially a laptop.
Yeah.
It came with a. Did it come with Windows 7 or Windows XP?
Yeah, it was XP. Wow. I was hard pressed to upgrade to 7, but I did that like.
Well, if you still have 7 around, it might be worth erasing the drive and starting over. I mean, that's a good idea anyway with Windows machines. What exactly is happening? Is it
the main thing is I'm not able to download information off my tablet.
It's just not modern enough.
It won't. Yeah, I tried to go into, and I may have messed something up in the registry. I tried to delete the Apple iOS thing to recognize your iPhone, iPad.
Oh, so you're trying to get an iPad connected up to it?
Yeah, and it just it says I got to update the Apple.
You need iTunes to connect up to it, and iTunes probably wants a more recent operating system. Holy cow! It's funny how Apple does this. They do it to everybody on a Mac, but it's amazing they can still do it to people on Windows too. I think Windows 7 should be modern enough. It's still a modern version of Windows. I mean, yeah, they went on to 8 and 8.1 and 10, but 7's not out of support. It's still active. A lot of people using Windows 7. I think really all you need to do is try reinstalling Windows 7. I'd back up your data, wipe off the drive, and start anew, get a good, clean install of Windows 7. As soon as you say things like, I might have messed up the registry, I go, oh boy, now's the time. Wipe the drive, start all over again, install Windows 7, install Apple's latest version of iTunes, and you should be able to do it. My guess is it's just, you know, it's old. I'm always amazed that people, I bet you the way you did this, you had XP, you installed 7 right on top of XP, and you probably haven't wiped that drive and reinstalled Windows since you got it. It's kind of remarkable it's still running. Windows does not age well. We call it bit rot. And I don't. It's just the nature of Windows and the way things are set up. The registry gets big. It's easy to errors propagate. It's easy for programs when they're installing to mess things up. And frankly, every year I will reinstall Windows on any Windows machines I use. Just start from scratch every year. It'll run faster. It'll work better. The drive will be better organized. And I think you should have no trouble getting that working. 8888 Ask Leo. If you got an idea for Dave, you can also go to our website, techilabs.com, and leave a comment or a suggestion. I know a few of you will go in there and say, well, Dave should just get Linux. It is true. Older systems like that Dell XPS, that 10-year-old Dell XPS, Dell's, by the way, a very good candidate for this, often run Linux very well. They have versions of Linux. It's a free operating system. It's not Windows. It's not Mac. It's a free operating system. And, you know, you can install it on there, maybe use a special version for older machines like Xubuntu, xubuntu.org. Download that, put it on there, and it'll run fine. You'll be able to do a lot of the things you want to do. But the one thing you won't be able to do, sounds like the one thing you really want to do, is connect your iPad up to it. For that, you need Windows. Moving on to Tom in Torrance, California. Hi, Tom. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Oh, thanks for taking my call, Leo.
Thanks for calling.
I have had a change in my computer system as far as getting Gmail and also having multiple windows open. I have the Chrome icon on the taskbar, and I usually right-click it to get another window when I need it. But right now, when I right-click it, it's just all black or gray. There's no previous sites that I've been to. And when I'm in Gmail, I cannot open any of the mail that I've received. I can star it or archive it or delete it, but I cannot open any of it. And it's just, I need it for work and things. So I thought I would ask.
ask
Leo.
Yeah, what the heck is going on? I've had Chrome do this on Windows myself, and on a brand new Microsoft Surface Studio running Windows 10, every once in a while, Chrome will just give me a blank black page. Let me ask you a couple questions. First of all, what version of Windows are you using?
10.
10. And you're using the most recent version of Chrome, I presume. It updates itself automatically. I almost don't even need to ask you that. But it's worth asking. If you haven't closed Chrome in a while, close it and reopen it, because when you do, it'll update to the most recent version. It kind of does that automatically. You can also, if Chrome is giving you fits, and this happens with every browser. This is not an unusual question for any browser. Because browsers, remember, cache pages they visited. They keep track of cookies and a lot of other things. And if it gets corrupted, if the data that's stored in its cache or its temp settings get corrupted, sometimes that'll make the browser misbehave. So you might want to take a look at resetting Chrome. You can find that in the settings menu of Chrome, and they've moved that around. I noticed they don't have that hamburger menu anymore. So I'm not sure where it would be on your system, but look for Chrome settings and then reset it in your browser settings. I'll put a link in the show notes to, let's see, Google's current advice is open Chrome at the top right, click more, dot, dot, dot. Although I noticed just today that my Chrome doesn't have that anymore. I wonder if they've taken it out of more recent versions of Chrome. But look for that more, dot, 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 sideways, dot, dot, dot. At the bottom, click advanced. Under the advanced section of settings, click reset. And they'll say confirm this, because you're going to reset, you're going to change it. But you do want to do that, because in that case, I think that probably you have a corrupt cache or corrupt data, and Chrome's just barfing on it. If that doesn't work, well, then you want to uninstall Chrome, and you can do that from a Windows control panel. Uninstall Chrome, download a fresh copy, and install it. There's one more diagnostic that you can do on Windows if something's not working well, which is create another account, or if you have another account, maybe an administrator account on your Windows machine, log out of your account and log into that and see if Chrome operates okay there. If it does, then Chrome's fine. It's just the particular stuff in your user profile, the cache, the temp files, the settings, and sometimes the extensions that's bothering Chrome. So that would give you a good indicator that it is time to either reset or reinstall. Our show today brought to you by, you probably know, IT Pro TV. Those guys at IT Pro TV are just killing it. I confess, I'm a little jealous. Tim and Don are IT trainers going way back, and they kind of saw what we did here at Twit, and they said, you know, this would be a really good way to do IT training. Have a live stream, IT, bring in the best IT trainers in every area of IT. Have them teach, have a chat room going just as we do. And then save those courses for on-demand viewing later. And they created IT Pro TV. Now they've got five studios. Five. Streaming live 125 hours a week of new content, which is great because IT is always changing. Even if you already have a great job in IT, you know you got to keep up. And that's where IT Pro TV is fabulous for training without leaving, the office. We're at home. You can watch IT Pro TV on your Chromecast, your Roku. They've got a great Apple TV app. They've got iOS and Android apps. Fire TV. Of course, on your PC, too. Their training is fabulously fun and engaging, and you learn at a cost that's much lower than a technical school, but much more fun and engaging. Get the certs you need to get the job you want. Just take a look at their course library at itpro.tv/techguy. You'll see every possible area of IT, including some of those great security certs from ISC Squared, the Certified Ethical Hacker, Kali Linux, AWSITIL. They've got team solutions too. If you're leading an IT team, and they can train you. You have the team portal, which means you can assign training. You can check how people are doing. Full control over the schedule. See individual and group analytics, logins, viewing time, video downloads, course completion traction. Whether you're anxious to start a new job in IT, or you're an IT pro looking for an engaging way to keep your team up to date or to polish your skills, I love this guy here. This is James Packer. He studied at IT Pro TV, got his dream job in the tropics, in the Cayman Islands.
I'm James Packer. I'm the general manager of Kirk ISS based in the Cayman Islands. We look after IT for banks, governments, and various other organizations around the Caribbean. IT Pro TV.
James did it at itpro.tv, and you can too. itpro.tv/tech guy. Find out about the team solution, request a free team trial. And if you're an individual, man, they've got a great deal for you. 7-day free trial. And 30% off the life of your subscription as long as you stay active. But you have to go to itpro.tv/tech guy and use the code TG30. TG30. 7 days free, 30% off your subscription, not just for the month, but forever. Premium subscriptions, which include unlimited Transcender practice exams, those are worth $100 by themselves. Virtual labs, normally that's $857 a year. Use that offer code, you'll only pay $600 a year. itpro.tv/tech guy. Use your offer code TG30. Flexible training, binge-worthy content, ROI proven. Join the more than 90,000 members at itpro.tv/tech guy. Leo Laporte, the tech guy. Cameron, Menifee, California. Hi, Cameron.
Hey, Leo.
Welcome.
How's it going?
Good.
Hey, I had a question about a mid-2010 MacBook Pro.
Okay. We're finally getting into the 21st century with these computers. That's good. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Hey, I was just wondering, I'm running OS 10, I think it's 9, OS 10 5 or 9.5. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering about how does the... Since my hardware is so old, how was the High Sierra?
You shouldn't have to. You know, I use, to be honest with you, I don't like the new Macs. I really hated the touch bar. I hate that. I more than hate the new keyboard. So I actually stuck with an older Mac laptop, not as old as yours, but I've used 2010s in the last few years. Mine's 2015. As long as you can install it, it should be fine. Apple will prevent you from installing the latest operating system if your computer's too old. I think a 2010 you should be. Is it mid or late 2010?
It's a mid 2010. It's a 17-inch with, I have upgraded RAM, and
I bet you it'll run just fine.
And also I was kind of wondering, I kind of need to do, because I haven't cleaned it since I've got it, so I kind of want to do like a get rid of a lot of stuff that's on there. That
yeah,
well,
this would
really
be good. This would be a good time to wipe the drive and start over. Then, yeah. Here's the way to do that. First of all, okay. Sounds like if you're a 10.9, I don't know. Do you have the App Store on there, the Mac App Store?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So if you go to the Mac App Store, you can download High Sierra, and actually, Apple has. It's very easy to put the Sierra and High Sierra installer on a USB key. But Apple has the instructions. We'll put a link in the show notes. But basically, you but don't install it. Don't run the installer yet. Just download it's called Install OS 10 High Sierra, I think. You download that. It'll be in your applications folder. You right-click mm-hmm. on it to get into the contents of that. It looks like a single file, but it's actually a folder. And inside there's a Mac OS program called Install High Sierra. You can actually burn that to a USB key and then have a USB key that's an installer. And that's probably what you'll want to do. You'll reboot your Macintosh, hold down the Option key, and boot into that installer on the USB key. And before you do anything else, run Disk Utility and wipe the drive. Now, make sure you back up everything first, obviously, right?
Okay, and that's the Macintosh HD drive, right?
Yeah.
There's a couple drives in there.
That's the internal drive. You're probably going to A couple of drives, huh?
I'm not sure if they're drives, but they
might be partitioned. Look at with disk utility and see. You could probably repartition the drive and have a single partition. That's not a bad idea. Actually, you know, one other thing you might look at, it'd be a great upgrade, is get an SSD for that old laptop and speed it up a lot. And so that'd be another option here. If you're going to do that, go to Otherworld Computing, maxsales.com, and they divide their hard drives up by model, and you can see if they offer an upgrade for that model. If they do, they'll give you the tools. They have videos. You can walk your way through it. Those older MacBooks are pretty easy. There's just a bunch of screws, Pentalobe screws on the bottom that you unscrew, and then you pull it out, and you can see it's a very easy upgrade to make. I actually did that with my 2015 MacBook because I needed more capacity. I wanted more speed, and that's been a very nice upgrade. The truth is Intel processors in the last 5, 6, 7 years haven't really gotten that much faster. You probably have a Core Duo in there. It'd probably be okay.
It's 2.8 gigahertz.
Yeah. You know what? that's fine. It's faster than some current day Macs in some respects. It's not multi. It's dual core, probably not, you know, four core, but there. I mean, a dual core, 3.8 gigahertz. That sounds pretty good to me. Should run High Sierra fine. If you really want to speed it up, you already added RAM, so you've already been in there. Same process. Go in there and put in a new hard drive in. But again, I'd go to Otherworld Computing and see if they offer an upgrade for that model, the 17-inch. A lot of people keeping those 17 inches around. Apple stopped making giant screens. It's absolutely worth recovering that thing. It's a pretty nice system. And thank you for the call. I think Apple's really taken a wrong turn with the Mac laptops. I'm sure they'll have some new ones, probably announce them in June. And Apple, please, I know you think people want super thin laptops, but what's happened with these really thin MacBooks is that the key travel has gotten to be so little, I feel like I'm stubbing my fingers on that keyboard. Do you know what I mean? Have you tried the new Mac keyboards? They're terrible. They're just terrible. And it makes them unusable for me. So I know I'm not alone in this. Touch bar, I can give her. I mean, that's a waste of money, waste of time, but I can live with it. But you got to get a better keyboard in there. Kara, is it Kara? No, wait a minute. Yeah. Kara, last call of the day. Hi, Kara. Leo Laporte, the tech guy.
Hi, thank you so much for getting me on the air.
My pleasure. What can I do for you?
Well, I have a pretty ancient laptop, but it was expensive, and I'd like to try to keep it limping along as long as I can.
That's the theme of the day today.
Yeah. It's a Toshiba Satellite. It's an S55, and it keeps going into that loop of preparing automatic repair, and I have looked on every forum and tried everything.
You need a new hard drive, almost certainly.
Okay.
That's the first thing to go. That's your moving part, right? Moving parts die faster than solid state. In fact, this laptop, like the last one, really benefit from a solid state drive replacement. You can look online. I would Google the name and model number exactly and look for YouTube videos. You could try iFixit.com. They specialize in putting Fix-It videos up. But you'll find a video of somebody putting a new hard drive in that Toshiba and watch it.
What do I look? Oh, I'm sorry.
And just watch it and see if you feel comfortable doing it.
Okay. But what's the thing I've got? What do I order? What am I looking to buy specifically?
Well, and that's the trick. So you're going to go somewhere that sells hard drives for Toshibas specifically. It doesn't have to be a Toshiba brand, but you do need a hard drive that fits. Probably it's a standard size 2.5-inch laptop drive. But when you look at this, one of the things this video will tell you is what drives you can use.
Okay.
And that's something you could totally do yourself. Usually it's just removing a few screws. These old big laptops from are really easy to get into. It's the modern super skinny laptops that have no user serviceable parts inside.
Okay, like where springs and stuff come out all over.
No, you're not going to, nothing like that. Nothing like that. But before I assure you that it can be done, because I can't assure you that, you're going to need to find a video somewhere where somebody's doing it and just look at it. And yeah, no springs will pop. It's designed really to be upgraded. The older laptops are. And that would be a very good upgrade for that laptop. And it would certainly solve that particular problem. Back up your data first. Hey, I'm out of time. Thanks to Michael Cozio, our musical director, Kim Schaffer for answering the phones. Thanks to you for being here. I'll see you next time. Leo Laporte, the Tech Guy. Have a great geek week. Well, that's it for the Tech Guy show for today. Thank you so much for being here. And don't forget, TWIT, T-W-I-T. It stands for This Week in Tech, and you'll find it at twit.tv, including the podcasts for this show. We talk about Windows on Windows Weekly, Macintosh on Mac Break Weekly, iPads, iPhones, Apple Watches on iOS Today, Security on Security Now. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And, of course, the big show every Sunday afternoon, This Week in Tech. You'll find it all at twit.tv. And I'll be back next week with another great Tech Guys show. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you next time.